For the next little while, we're going to do pure sociology. Ferdinand Tonies, T-O-N-N-I-E-S, Ferdinand Tonies, developed out of the Weberian school, Max Weber's school of thought, a differentiation between two types of social systems in which people live. The one is called a Gemeinschaft, the other is called a Gesellschaft. Now, those who come out of German backgrounds ought to know those words. Gemeinschaft largely translates like community, whereas Gesellschaft is a society. But I'm going to break it down very carefully. Gemeinschaft. You can look these words up in the back of your Palin book. They're there. They're part of what it's all about in sociology. A Gemeinschaft is a community in which people know each other personally, face to face. All relationships are personal relationships. Let me just say quite simply this. An ideal Gemeinschaft is when everybody in the community is a blood relative. You say, I'm not sure I know what that's like. Well, you don't know what it was like for me coming out of West Philadelphia to end up in a rural church in New Jersey, Chesterfield, New Jersey. And the first Sunday, the first guy out of church is George Longstreet. The next guy out of church is George Longstreet. The third person out of church was another Longstreet. The next guy out was a Borden. I said, phew. I was beginning to think that everybody in this church was part of the Longstreet family. He looked at me and he said, I'm married to a Longstreet. Everybody in this community knew everybody. Everybody in this community, in one way or another, was almost related. There were some that weren't related, to be sure, but it was almost a Gemeinschaft. A pure Gemeinschaft is everybody's related, everybody's a blood relative. You see, this is very important. It had a two-room schoolroom. You didn't call the roll because it would be the same last name all the time. Everybody knew everybody. Everybody was aware of everybody. You know what they didn't have in Chesterfield? A police department. You know why they didn't need to have a police department? Because the whole town is a police department. If some kid did something that was delinquent, the whole town would call the mother and say, did you see what he did? I saw him on the street. You need to take care of this. The whole town watched over and protected each other. You don't have to worry about burglars because anybody that's strange that appeared in the town was immediately recognizable. The Gemeinschaft. Now, here's the most important thing about a Gemeinschaft. In a Gemeinschaft where everybody knows each other in what we call in sociology, everybody has a primary relationship. Get that? A primary relationship. These are terms that sociologists use all the time. A primary relationship with every other member of the community. Where that's the case, every time you change functions, you find you're doing what you're doing with the same group of people. The same group is involved with the same people are involved with each other no matter what the activity is, i.e., if the children go to school, they go to school with members of the family. If you go to church, guess what? It's members of the family. They had a mayor in the town, member of the family. The political system, the educational system. You had a little league team. You have Longstreet at first, Longstreet at second. You have a Borden at shortstop. You got to, you know, no matter what you do, it's the same group of people. You never leave this context of everybody knowing of everybody else, of people having a primary connectedness with each other. Have you got it? Have you got a plot? You understand what I'm dealing with here? Now, when you move into the city, you move into what sociologists would call a Gesellschaft. And a Gesellschaft, in its purest form, is a societal system where every time you change activities, you change groups. So you go to school with one group of people. You go to church with another group of people. You know, the kid that goes to West Philadelphia High goes to church, but nobody from West Philadelphia High is in the church. Do you follow this? It's a totally different group of people. If he joins a little league team, It's a totally different group of people. If this kid gets involved in any activity, it's a different group of people. His father may belong to a bowling league. Nobody else in the family knows the other people who are in the league with him. Every person belongs to groups, each of which is different and none of which have overlaps with the other groups. Do you have this situation on our hands? This is very important for this reason. Sociologists like Charles Cooley, another name you have to know, contends that a person's self-identity is generated by the significant others in his group. I am what the group defines me as being. For instance, if I was on an island, let's say there was a plane crash. I'm an old guy, and the only other people on the airplane were 35-year-old women. And I'm the only guy.
That's tough, man.
Yeah, I'm the only guy. Got the picture? After about a month, I would begin to look good. Right? After 2 months, I think most of them would be in love with me. After 3 months, not only would they think that I was handsome and debonair, but if they were all defining me this way, guess what? I would say, you know, I guess I am debonair. I guess I am handsome. Namely, here's Charles Cooley. Get this concept down pat. An individual's self-concept is contingent on what that person thinks the significant others around him think of him or her. Right? So if the significant others around me all define me a particular way, I accept that definition of who I am. My self-concept is contingent upon what I think the others in the group think of me. Now, the interesting thing is, I said that very carefully. I didn't say what the other people think of me. I said what I think the other people think of me. I mean, if I may be surrounded by a bunch of people that think I'm the ugliest thing that's ever come down the pike, doesn't make any difference as long as I think they think I'm handsome. It's what I think they think of me that determines what I think of myself. Charles Cooley, here's the concept. It's the looking glass self. The looking glass self. Got that? Now, in the Gemeinschaft, you're only with one group of people. No matter what you do, you're with the same group of people. Therefore, the self-concept that is derived in that association, in that Gemeinschaft, in that small group of people, is the concept of self that you will live with. How many self-concepts will you have? One. One self-concept. Why? Because you only belong to one group. No matter what you do, you're always with the same group of people. Do you follow this? My identity is totally established by this one group of people. This is very, very important. Very, very important. When you move into Gesellschaft, every time you change activities, you're with a different group of people. Every one of those groups defines you differently. Let's say let me tell you, at a particular stage of my life, I was a full-time teacher at Eastern and at the University of Pennsylvania, where it overlaps for 4 years, where I taught full-time at both schools. And I was also preaching. Every weekend I was out preaching in churches. Here's my problem. I go to Eastern and I'm Tony. That's it. Tony Campolo. That's it. I'm Tony. I don't know. I'm speaking in chapel and they usually announce the chapel speakers on this video thing out here. And I didn't look at it yet, but I have a feeling it'll say Tony Campolo is speaking in chapel. And you say, what? Well, at the University of Pennsylvania, I wasn't Tony Campolo. I was Dr. Anthony Campolo. I was Dr. Campolo. Here I'm Tony. There I was Doctor. I'm Doctor. I'm Tony. At that same time, my children were living at home. And I was Dad. So I wake up in the morning, and I have breakfast, and they define me. You're Daddy. I go to the University of Pennsylvania. I become Dr. Campolo. come out in the afternoon, I become Tony. And that evening I go out and speak at a church and I become Saint Anthony. Every time I change groups, the definition changed. Do you understand why at the end of the day I might look in the mirror and say what? Will the real Tony Campolo please step forward? Am I going to suffer from an identity crisis? Because I belong to so many different groups, each of which defines me differently, I don't know who I am. So in a Gesellschaft, there's going to be identity crises. You're going to have a social psychological problem that does not exist in the Gemeinschaft. I mean, in the Gemeinschaft, you're always George Longstreet's son. Go to school, you're George Longstreet's son. No matter what you do, you're George Longstreet's son. Hey, that's the way it is in a Gemeinschaft. In a Gesellschaft, you get a different self-concept in each and every group. I remember going out to speak at a church on the Jersey coast. And there was, it was a church to which one of the students here at Eastern was a member. And the guy was a hellion here on campus. I mean, we were close to expelling him because, you know, he'd go out and drink. And we're not into a drinking school. You can't drink on campus, but he'd go off campus. And he was a mess. And he was foul-mouthed, and he was just a, you know, just say, what are you doing at a Christian college? So I went to speak at this church, and I found out he was a member of the church. And the people got off on, oh, it's wonderful when he's here during the summer. He never misses a church service. He always attends prayer meeting. So, are you kidding? Are we talking about the same guy? Oh, yes, he's the leader of the youth group. Let me tell you, he is such a spiritual dynamo. You're lucky to have him at your school. And I'm saying, are we talking about the same guy? So when I got back to campus, I met the guy in the hall, down here in Walton Hall. And, you know, Campolo's tough. I grabbed him, shoved him up against the wall. I said, hey, I was at your church last night. Have you got those people conned? They think you're super saint. What a phony you are. Of course, the question is, which is the real Johnny? The one that was at the church or the one that's at the school? Because please understand, they're two different people. They're two different people. And I said, there's no consistency to your life, is there? His head went down. He said, no, there isn't. The result is that following summer, he didn't go to church at all. But at least he was moving towards a unified concept of personhood. You know, I'm not going to be one person here and another person there. Do you see what the problem is? Very often, if you're working in the inner city, you're going to have to work with kids who get in deep trouble. Maybe rob a bank or rob a store or beat somebody up. And you'll come home and you'll get the kid and you'll arrest the kid. And you go to the parents' home and say, your son did such and such. And the parents can be counted on to say this. My son would never do anything like that. And you know what? They're absolutely right. Their son wouldn't do that. But they're living in a Gesellschaft. And when he leaves that family and goes to be with the gang on the street corner, they give him a new self, a new identity, a new definition of who he is. He's one person with the family, he's another person with the, and as a member of the street corner gang, he does break in and beat up old ladies. As a member of the family, he would never think of doing that. You change groups, and you're going to run into this all the time. You're going to run into multiple personality structures because people live in a Gesellschaft. Cities are Gesellschaft systems. Incidentally, you now know what being a Christian is. Being a Christian, and let me say this, is not simply believing in Jesus and what he did on the cross. Being a Christian is to follow Thomas A. Kempis, who talked about practicing the presence of Christ. Namely, to become a Christian is not just to believe in Jesus, but to allow Jesus to become the significant other in your life. And you know what that means? That means whether you're home, whether you're on the ball team, whether you're at school, whether you're at the factory, no matter where you are, Christ is there, and his definition of who you are takes precedence over whatever a group wants to do. You create integrity of personality. If Jesus is not somebody you believe in on Sunday, but is a constant presence in your life, so that even as you change groups in the Gesellschaft setting wherein you live, you are always orienting your behavior to Jesus. And who you are is always defined in terms of who he is. That is very, very important. Any questions on this? I mean, it's such a simple thing. And the minute you say it, you say, when I say sociology is an elaboration of the obvious, you say, this is obvious. Yes, but what sociology does so brilliantly is puts it into neat little forms that you say, ah, yes, that explains a lot of things that I always knew, but never was able to put into words. I now know what we're dealing with. Incidentally, the types of personality differ in this respect. David Riesman, another sociologist you should know, wrote a book which is a classic in the field. And if you're a sociology student in undergraduate school, you've read this book. It's called The Lonely Crowd. The Lonely Crowd by David Riesman. In it, he talks about types of personalities that emerge in different settings. He talks about the person in the Gesellschaft who says he's a member of the group, but he's lonely. Most people living in a Gesellschaft are with a group, but they feel lonely. You know why? Because they know that the other members of the group don't know who they really are. They are playing a con job. They know they're playing a con job. This person is called, here's the word, other-directed personality. People in a Gesellschaft develop an other-directed personality. In short, they develop a skill in a Gesellschaft. Kids growing up in the city develop this skill. And the skill is that they learn how to read a group very quickly and then quickly adapt their behavior, their language, their very way of walking so that it conforms to the expectations of the group. He walks into the group. It takes him very little time to figure out what this group expects of him and then conforms to those expectations. Do you see that? But he's saying to himself in the back of his mind, they don't know about the other selves. My son played on the Radnor High School basketball team. And it was funny. Because I got to say this about my son, and I'll brag about this. He didn't play games, Gesellschaft games. The team would come out, and he was a star. He would come out, and they'd go through the layups. And just before it was time to tap off, he'd look in the stands, and he'd see us. And he'd run up into the stands. Other mothers envy this, and kiss his mother. Most ball players, what? They don't want anybody to know that their mother's here. See? I don't want to. It'll blow my cool, man. Last thing I want them to know is that I kiss my mother. Do you see this? And everybody, people would always say, "Oh, I don't believe that. That he actually acknowledged that he has parents." Most kids don't want to acknowledge that they have parents. Do you see? But they live in a lonely crowd because they say there are other selves. There are other selves that people don't know about. Paul Tournier talks about people in the following forms. And I see what Paul Tournier is talking about every May, because students come into my office and say something like this: "Well, Doc, I'm not coming back next semester." I try to be professional. Pray tell. Why? The kid's going to say, "I need time. I need time." And I'm saying to myself, he hasn't done anything for the last 3 months. But you know why he needs time. He's going to say, "I need time to find myself." See, he's got an identity crisis. Going to find myself. And they all look in the same place. Boulder, Colorado. Then it becomes quite strained. "Doc, what I'm trying to tell you is I'm tired of playing these roles that others have prescribed for me. I'm tired of being the self that my friends expect me to be, that the church expects me to be, that my family expects me to be, that the school expects me to be. I'm tired of playing these socially prescribed roles. I've got to peel away each of these socially prescribed identities, each of these socially generated personas, and come to grips with the core of my being, the essence of my selfhood. Kind of makes you puke, doesn't it? I mean, when you hear that. And I always say the same thing. Charlie, suppose after you peel away each of these socially prescribed identities, after you peel away each of these socially constructed selves, you find out you're an onion. You're an onion. If you peel away all the skins of an onion, what do you got left? Nothing. The onion's nothing more than the sum total of its skins. Charlie, you may be nothing more than the sum total of all the roles that society has taught you to play. That after you take this long guru journey into the innermost recesses of your being, get there, hi-ho, nobody's home. The existentialist philosophers understood this well. They said that the whole idea that there's an essential self waiting to be discovered comes out of Greek philosophy. It was the Greeks, Plato, Aristotle, particularly Plato, believed that before you were ever born in this world, you lived in a world of pure archetypes. You were a pure spiritual essence. And then something terrible happened. You took on human flesh. And the flesh is evil and smothers the spirit. But you can be delivered. The Oracle of Delphi says to Socrates what? Know thyself. That implies what? There's a self waiting to be known through introspection. Know thyself. Know thyself. But what if there is no self to be found? What if the existentialists are right? What if Jean-Paul Sartre, another name you should know, is right? Sartre, S-A-R-T-R-E, Jean-Paul Sartre. Being in Nothingness is his classic book. What if the self is not waiting to be discovered? What if the self is waiting to be created? And there's only one way to create a self. There's only one way to create identity. There is only one way to create selfhood, and that's through your commitments. Your commitments, according to the existentialists, define you ultimately. They are what give you an essence, an essential self that transcends all the self concepts that others would prescribe for you. What is your ultimate commitment? You can see how this fits into Christianity, can't you? If a person commits himself to Christ, to doing the will of God, if a woman says, Jesus is my all in all, I'm going to be totally committed to Christ in everything I do, in everything I think, in everything I say, Christ is Lord of all of my life. Not just the life that I live with the ball team, not just the life I live at school, not just the life I live in the business community. Not, he's going to be Lord of all. I love that phrase, Lord of all. He's going to be in control of me no matter where I am, defining me no matter where I am. I'm going to be committed to doing his will no matter where I am. I now have an essential self. I now have an essential self. You say, but what about those who are not committed? Jean-Paul Sartre says it well. He says, if you're not committed, you don't have an essential self. Or in the words of T.S. Eliot, you're the hollow man, the empty man, the straw man blown to and fro by the wind. The essential self is created in the context of commitment. Do you see how when I stand up and say, Jesus Christ is the answer, I'm not just throwing those words around like a lot of people do. When you're a sociologist, you say, yes, he is the answer. Because if I enter into this committed relationship with Christ, I have for the first time an essential self. The self is not waiting to be discovered. It's waiting to be created by commitment. And the problem with young people that you're going to have to deal with in the city, everywhere you go, is that they're Gesellschaft, other-directed personalities who have never made a commitment in their lives. And they are hollow, and they are empty, and they are drifting, and they are, in fact, able to be swept into whatever group that they're with. And if the group is going to steal from people and beat up old ladies, they'll do that. If the group's going to be positive, they'll do that. Do you see that? Christ is the only way. I don't know how else you can come up with an identity. I don't know how else you can come up with an essential self except through commitments. So that's the issue. The issue is choose ye this day. Christianity, in the end, drives you to decision-making, drives you to say, am I going to make a commitment? And a commitment isn't just that I'm going to believe in Jesus and go to heaven when I die. A commitment is, am I willing to live with the presence of Christ in all that I do? Am I willing to allow him to be Lord of my life? Am I going to orient my life to serving in him? Have I committed my entire future into his hands? Whoa, this is going way beyond believing. Way beyond believing. You see, this is very, very, very crucial. Mission year is funny. You know why? Because you go to a youth rally and you give an invitation and you say, all of those who want to give their lives to Christ, come down the aisle. And they come down the aisle, hundreds of them. Well, they're all there. And they go in the back room and you say a prayer. And as they're coming out, you say, we got this thing called Mission Year. We'd like you to give a year of your life to working among the poor and the needy in the inner city. And they look at you and say, a year? Do I have to do a whole year? Please, don't get me wrong. I don't mind giving my life to Jesus. But a whole year? Do you see the incongruity of this? And people talk and talk and talk about commitment. They don't know what commitment is. I always love to use stories. And one of my favorite stories is Blondin the tightrope walker, who strung a tightrope from one end of the Niagara Falls to the others. In the late 1800s, he inched his way from the Canadian side to the U.S. side. And when he got there, the crowd gathered, started chanting his name. Blondin, Blondin, Blondin. He quieted the crowd. He said, I'm going back across the tightrope. But this time I will carry someone on my shoulders. Do you believe I can do that? Again, the crowd screamed out, we believe, we believe, we believe. And he said, all right, which of you will be that individual? The crowd went silent. One man, it turned out to be his business manager who saw a good thing going down the tubes, stepped forward and said, I'll do it. And he climbed on Blondin's shoulders. I guess because he had seen Blondin and he knew what he could do and trusted him. And for the next 2.5 hours, Blondin inched his way back to the Canadian side of the falls. Point of the story, 10,000 people said, I believe, I believe, I believe, I believe. Only one really believed, and that he committed his whole life into the hands of the one in whom he said he believed. And I look at the church, and I see it filled with people who every Sunday say, I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered on the body. But in the end, they have not really believed. Believing is this commitment through which we get our identities. So you've got some basic concepts down here. Now, what we're dealing with here is the difference between urbanization and urbanism. Urbanization deals with demography and with population and with the environment in which you live and the technology that's available. There's a word for it called poet. That is often used by urban sociologists, poet. Population, here's a group of people. A city is a group of people that have a particular population, a type of organization, have a particular kind of environment, and have a certain level of technology. These are the characters. So when you analyze a city, you always analyze it. Who's here? How many people? What's the demography? You analyze, how's the city organized? And we'll talk about the way in which cities are organized. What's the environment of the city? Obviously, the environment of Paris is very different than the environment of Peoria, Illinois. And what's the technology that's available in this place? That'll have a great deal to do with the city. So poet, it's a very important concept, poet. Got that down? When we analyze cities, we are going to be dealing with them in this way. Poet is a crucial concept in urbanization. Now, when people get urbanized, you analyze them utilizing the poet criteria. Poet becomes the instrument by which you deal with urbanization. When I talk about the kinds of personalities that emerge in cities, i.e. the other directed personality that emerges in a Gesellschaft, I'm not talking about urbanization, I'm talking about urbanism. Urbanism is kind of a way of life, a way of life. What I will point out, incidentally, is this. I heard somebody say he was from Ames, Iowa. Who was that? Oh, Ames, Iowa. Okay, let's go to a small town in Iowa. Small communities, you got a lot of them. This is not an urbanized area. This guy lives on a farm. He's 2 miles outside of this town, and the town only has about 300 people in it. He's certainly not urbanized. But the situation is that he lives in a world where he's got a television set and he's got a disc outside the house that gives him 75 channels. And the way he lives is highly prescribed by television. He begins to dress in a certain way. He begins to talk in a certain way. He begins to get values that are very different than the values of the small town. This is one of the modern phenomena, that you don't have to live in a city to experience urbanization. So he becomes urban in his consciousness, even though he is not living in a Gesellschaft. Now, of course, there are differentiations between the urbanized person and somebody who has been urbanized. But the differentials will be explained later on. But do you see this happening? So when we talk about urban sociology, we have to recognize we're not just dealing anymore with people who live in the city. We're dealing with the fact that cities define the character of people from one end of this country to the other. Let me give you something that's very obvious to a sociologist. If you were to ask the typical American, is the media liberal or is it conservative right wing? They will say, except for Fox News, television is very, very liberal. That's the popular concept. If you were to go around and actually interview these people who are newscasters, the Brian Williams of the world, you will find they have the following characteristics. They all come from small Midwestern towns. Good example? Johnny Carson, Iowa, little town. They all come from the Midwest. You know why they come from the Midwest? Because the Midwest produces the one group of people that do not have an accent. That's right. I mean, you come from Boston, you know, right? You come from the South, you come from Birmingham, Alabama, you know. You come from the Pacific Southwest, listen to them talk, you know. Come from Iowa, you can't figure them out. Their language is almost devoid of accent. And so they all end up, if they're going into media, go to Northwestern University in Chicago, study communications, and go into television, you see. And they're perfect for the job. And then you begin to ask them about their political views. What the studies indicate overwhelmingly is that almost every newscaster on every television show in America is conservative. Coming out of these small Midwestern towns, they have conservative values, a conservative outlook on life. They are conservatives. You say, but I listen to the show, and the shows definitely have a liberal pitch. Of course they do. Because to put together a truck and a team to go out and get a story costs huge amounts of money. And so the television teams never report what's going on in the small town. In Oshkosh, in Tilton, Iowa. They don't know what's going on there. They don't go and cover things there. They cover things that are going on in the city. Who lives in the city? Well, first of all, the homosexuals are in the city. So people in America get the idea that homosexuals are taking over the country. Every time we turn on the set, there's demonstrations. Hey, you're in town. You're at the local television station. There's a demonstration clogging up the traffic on Main Street. Who are they? A bunch of gays. So you go down and report on it. If you were out in Tilton, Iowa, you wouldn't be reporting on a gay demonstration. Maybe there'd be one person with a flag. Do you see what's happening here? The truth is that news teams are only operating out of cities. They report what goes on in cities. Cities are the places that attract all the left-wing groups. Everything that happens in the city is wild. The sexual libertinism, the drugs, everything. It's city stuff to a most degree. Now drugs are beginning to move to the rural areas, and I guess David will tell you, you don't have to go to the city to get the drugs. They're into urbanism. They've got the urban way of life now in little towns all over the place. But do you see what's going on here? There's a book by a guy named Epstein. Epstein, E-P-S-T-E-I-N, Epstein. It's called News from Nowhere, in which he points out that news is not what's happening. News is what's happening where there's a camera crew. I'm old enough, and Daniel, you're old enough to remember the rise of the Ayatollah Khomeini and the whole mess in Iran. Came out of nowhere. We say, where did this guy come from? I mean, out of nowhere, this guy suddenly becomes a powerful force that defies the president of the United States and changes politics in the Middle East forever. Nobody knew he existed. Why? Because we didn't have a television team in Tehran. Everybody in Tehran knew who Ayatollah Khomeini was. Everybody in Iran knew who he was. But we didn't have a camera crew there. And so even though a world-shaking event was taking place as this Ayatollah was taking over the country, anybody outside of Tehran had no clue as to what was going on because we didn't have a camera crew there. Do you see what we mean by the fact that the world is being defined by a handful of camera crews in cities, and hence it looks like a completely liberal world out there. And you can put a conservative guy behind the desk, but if the only thing he's reporting is what's going on in the city, it's going to come across as very liberal. When there's a peace demonstration, it doesn't take place in Effort of Pennsylvania. It doesn't take place in Souderton. It takes place in Philadelphia. It takes place in Washington, D.C. Everything takes place in the city. Even if the people who are in the demonstration don't live in the city, that's where the demonstration is going to take place. So the cities attract those who are espousing countercultural values. And thus it will always appear that way in the media. Even though the people who are doing the reporting are conservative in their values, if you give them subject matter that's left-wing, no matter how conservative they are, if they're reporting on left-wing events, it's going to look liberal. Do you see the point? W.I. Thomas. Here's the line. It's a great sociological line. If things are real in the imagination, they are real in their consequences. What a great line. If things are real in the imagination, they're real in their consequences. It's not what's really happening in the world that's important. It's what people imagine is happening that is important.